Call the meeting to order of the Senate Finance Committee. Today is February the 6th. We're in the Capital City Senate Finance Committee room. Present today is Chairman Stedman. Chairman Olson is excused. Senator Keel, Senator Merrick, Senator Cronk, and Senator Kaufman. Today we'll be going over a presentation by the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. Please join us at the table. The chairman of the Board of Trustees, Brent Fisher, along with Dr. Mary Wilson, who's the chief executive officer. Please come to the committee and identify yourself and use any additional staff that you might need. But please proceed with your presentation.
I'm Brent Fisher. I am the chair of the Board of Trustees of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. I have been on the board for 4 years and was elected to be chair in November. And I thank you very much for the opportunity to present today. This slide shows a list of the members of our current Board of Trustees, and many of my fellow trustees are here in the room with us this morning. Agnes Moran is our vice chair and chair of Program and Planning Committee. She is here. Kevin Feynman, he's the chair of Audit and Risk Committee. And Anita Halterman, one of our trustees that serves on committees. Those who are not present in the room today are Rhonda Boyles, the secretary of the board, Corey Fahey, the chair of the Resource Management Committee, and John Morris, who's our Finance Committee chair. The Board of Trustees is an independent board, and we provide governance, fiduciary oversight, and direction to the organization in achieving the mission of the trust. Trustees have five-year terms and are appointed by the governor and must be confirmed by the legislature. You'll often hear board members and staff refer to trust beneficiaries. This slide shows who those beneficiaries are. Alaskans who these are considered to be the beneficiaries of the trust and Alaskans who experience one or more of the conditions that you see on the slide. We support both youth and adult beneficiaries, and we prioritize individuals with behavioral health condition or developmental disability that place them at risk of institutionalization if they don't have proper community-level support and services. We also consider prevention of these conditions when possible to be a part of our mandate, and we have been looking more recently at preventive services before folks get too their conditions become too severe. Supporting our beneficiaries and helping improve their life and health outcomes is the reason that our board and our staff are committed to the trust. The Alaskan Mental Health Trust Authority, often referred to as the Trust, is a state corporation that administers the Alaska Mental Health Trust, which is a perpetual trust, to improve the lives of beneficiaries. We have a unique place in state government. We are an independent state corporation, and we use the proceeds of our land and cash assets to help ensure that Alaska has a comprehensive suite of mental health and disability services that meet the needs of our beneficiaries and our communities. We do this through grant making and through advancing efforts to improve our system of care for our beneficiaries. And while we are an independent corporation, we use our resources to partner closely with the state, local governments, nonprofits, tribal partners, providers, and others who advance our mission. We prioritize our funds for system improvement, innovation, and strategic initiatives. The Trust Land Office, also overseen by the Board of Trustees, and which we'll talk about in more detail later in the presentation, is contracted exclusively by the Trust to manage its approximately 1 million acres of land and other non-cash assets to generate revenue over time to better serve our beneficiaries. Now, before I turn the floor over to our new CEO, Dr. Mary Wilson, I'd like to acknowledge that the Trust Authority celebrated its 30th anniversary last year. We have a rich history that goes all the way back to pre-statehood, and when Alaska did not receive enough services to meet the needs of the Trust beneficiaries. We've developed a short video that we'd like to share with you that does a great job communicating our organization's recent history as well as how we generate and invest trust funds.
Before we go to that, I would like to acknowledge the presence of two senators, Senator Giesels in the audience and Senator Halford, also former Senate President, is in the audience as well. And he was here when the trust was formed. Please proceed.
This is a story about something called the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority, the trust for short. It's pretty complex, but for many Alaskans who need help dealing with mental health issues, the trust often means the difference between a healthy, productive life and a much different path. The trust was created in 1994 after beneficiary groups sued the state of Alaska for not living up to its obligation to care for people who were mentally ill or had developmental disabilities. The two sides reached a settlement, and the state granted the trust 1 million acres of land and $200 million in cash. The trust is the only one of its kind in the whole country. But what is it? Think of the trust like a garden. In the garden, there are all sorts of valuable crops like cash, land, buildings, gold, coal, natural gas, and timber. All that land and cash is invested, generating the money for beneficiary-related programs across the state. In fact, the trust gets no money from the state's general fund. While the trust is a state corporation, it's more like a private foundation. The trust's cash investments are managed by the Permanent Fund Corporation, and the land and non-cash assets are managed by a subset of the trust authority called the Trust Land Office. The trust helps pay for programs and services that help improve the lives of beneficiaries. These are Alaskans with mental illness, developmental disabilities, chronic alcohol and drug addiction, Alzheimer's disease and related dementia, and traumatic brain injury. Every year, the trust awards more than $20 million in grants, but it does a lot of other important things, too. The trust is a leader in advocacy and policy, planning, and ensuring the state has a comprehensive integrated mental health program. And the trust spends a lot of attention on key efforts that can really help beneficiaries, including substance abuse prevention and treatment, housing and long-term services and supports, employment, and disability justice. So that's the essence of the trust. If you'd like to know more, go to our website. You'll find us at alaskamentalhealthtrust.org.
Hi, everybody. Mary Wilson. I'm the brand new CEO of the Trust, like 2 weeks. So I have a lot of the team sitting behind me if you have questions later that they're going to help me with. So hopefully that'll be helpful. I just wanted to share a little bit about me since I'm new. I'm a pediatrician. My family moved up to Anchorage when I was a little kid, and I graduated from Diamond High. There, and then I went to college in Colorado and medical school at the University of Washington through the WAMI program, where I spent part of the first year in Fairbanks. And actually, at that point, got a big interest in public health. Went down in PEDS, you train for 3 years, and then you can do a fellowship. So I trained at University of California in San Diego, and then went up to UCLA to get a master's in public health as well as a fellowship in early childhood development. And so I'm in my master's in public health, it was around healthcare policy, and I was very and remain very interested in how one impacts a population. For a physician, you impact an individual a great deal in a one-on-one encounter, but you quickly see that there's a lot happening before they come in and after they leave that really impacts their health more than you do. And so I'm very interested in that. And that dovetails with the work that the trust does that you just heard about. So I went to work in Southern California with Kaiser Permanente, with the Permanente Medical Group, and there rose into different leadership positions. And I think that might be important to you only because it informs a skill set I might have to offer for the trust. So I had a East San Fernando Valley, if you know L.A. I was in charge of the delivery system out there for a while, the systems of access and service in Southern California. And then finally, my last stint was 6 years in Georgia as president of the Southeast Permanente Medical Group. So it's a physician group. And then about 3 years ago, moved back to Alaska. My family's here, and I really wanted to be back home. And we bought a house, and we live in Anchorage. And then several people told me about this opportunity, and I thought it might fit me. So that's what I'm sitting here today for. So thank you very much for that. So I'm going to go through some slides of our financial position. And I'm just going to walk you through this slide so you can take a look at what money we have, where it comes from. So our overall story, as you can see, is one of steady growth in our assets since our inception, and that reflects prudent board management of the trust assets. Cash resources and investments at the end of last fiscal year were $788.5 million, plus $59.8 million in real estate equity, for a total assets of $848 million. And that's a modest increase over the previous year, which was $818 million. In the green bar, you'll see the Mental Health Trust Fund, which is managed by the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. And we refer to that as our corpus. That's the green line. That's $551 million. Last year, it was $538 million. So again, a modest increase. Overall, since its inception in 1996, our corpus has grown due to revenues from activities on trust lands and permanent transfers for inflation proofing, as well as the growth itself. We use a 4-year average to calculate our annual withdrawal from the trust fund and to develop our budget. Therefore, we're able to be a stable and reliable funding partner to Alaska's beneficiary serving partners. For trust reserves, that's the blue bar, $129 million, we have reserves so that we can prudently ensure available spending for beneficiaries even during periods of market downturns. And then we have unrealized appreciation, shown in red, that's $108 million. And that varies year to year. Unrealized appreciation is basically based on market value and not available for spending until it is realized. And the APFC investment team tells us when it can be realized. And finally, in the dark blue, that's our real estate equity. And that is, I have a slide later which will discuss it, but commercial real estate has an equity value, which is shown here, and it's contributed to our overall growth of our financial investments. And the next slide, I'll talk a little bit more about the commercial real estate portfolio. There's an additional asset not included in the chart, and that's the approximately 1 million acres of trust lands, which my understanding is it's not possible really to assess the financial value of 1 million acres, but it's there and it's ours.
Senator Stedman.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just for clarity, help me with the unrealized appreciation. Is that part of the overall portfolio that's used to calculate your withdrawal rate of 4.25%, or whatever it is?
From the chair to the senator? The question is, does the unrealized appreciation go into our spendable calculation?
No, I'm trying to get a feel for the overall market value of the corpus of the trust, your portfolio that is managed a little differently from the permanent fund, and it appears that the trust portfolio is growing a little faster than the permanent fund, and we've seen here at the table, Mr. Chairman, that the permanent fund's kind of leveled off in growth the last few years, and that's is concerning to us.
Oh, okay. And so I think I'm going to get Julie up here to just go through some of the finances and make sure I answer your question properly. Okay, she's our CFO.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you. For the record, this is Julie Farley, the CFO of the Alaska Mental Health Trust. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, could you repeat your question so I answer it more fully?
I'm trying to relate the chart here to your actual managed portfolio.
Okay.
And the market value of that, and watching, you know, you've got a 4-year look back, smoothing of your withdrawals, a little bit different than the 5-year look back of the permanent fund. And the permanent fund has... growth has kind of leveled off. It's got a higher growth or a higher withdrawal rate at 5. So the withdrawal rates are different, and the look back time frame is different. but the performance of the trust portfolio is looking pretty good over the years. And we've seen it here at the table where it's weathered several different economic cycles fairly well. And we're having some concern with the permanent fund's lack of growth. You know, it's the last handful of years for various reasons. Anyway, so I'm just trying to make sure I'm comparing an apple to an apple and not an apple to an orange too much.
Thank you.
And I just don't know if unrealized appreciation is part of the marketable securities in your portfolio or it's something else.
Thank you. Through the chair to Senator Steadman. Yes, unrealized appreciation is included in the value of the mental health trust fund on which the 4.25% payout each year is calculated.
Senator Steadman.
That's fine, Mr. Chairman. Maybe in some future presentation we can actually have a comparison between the mental health trust portfolio versus the permanent fund portfolio because there's different asset classes used in different structures. But it doesn't go unnoticed that the performance of the mental health trust portfolio in the long term has been very good.
Thank you, Senator Steadman. Dr. Wilson, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. So this is just to talk about the commercial real estate that the trust has been involved in. These assets have been of interest to lawmakers. Here's a brief update on what's going on with commercial real estate at the trust. These assets are managed by the professionals at the trust land office and are actively managing the properties. Last year, the Board of Trustees determined it was in the trust's best interest to sell the commercial real estate portfolio, having met its investment objectives. The properties were purchased and managed as 7 to 20-year investments, and at this point, the newest property is 8 years old. So all of the properties are within the anticipated holding period. Since then, two properties are now sold, representing gains for the trust. There are currently four properties remaining in the portfolio. One is in Alaska and three are in Texas. In addition, the Board of Trustees also have decided to cease the acquisition of any new CRE properties. These properties, as you can see, have performed well in terms of average occupancy as well as just as national benchmarks sent by the National Council of Real Estate Investment Fiduciaries. So in summary, we have the commercial real estate properties are shown in the previous graph, and we're selling them currently and will not be acquiring new assets.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Dr. Wilson, welcome aboard.
Thank you.
I missed some math. You said there were seven, sold two. Now there are four.
Yeah, there was one. What my understanding is one trust-owned property has been reclassified as a program real estate property since it houses TLO staff. So it leases space to beneficiary-serving organizations. So it's been reclassified from commercial real estate into program-related real estate.
Senator.
So that leaves six properties. I believe that's your question. Sorry, through the chair to the
Senator Keel.
So I apologize for simplifying. So it was an investment, and now it's the trust's office?
That,
Dr. Wilson.
From the chair through Senator Keel. I might get some history from the folks behind me. I think that would be helpful. Thanks. You'll have to introduce yourself.
Please identify yourself for the record.
Good morning. My name is Justy Warner. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Land Office through the chair, Senator Keel. The property that is being discussed and has been reclassified as program-related real estate has always held the Trust Land Office, housed them. It most recently is now serving beneficiary-serving organizations that may not be aimed towards being income-producing tenants. And so it was appropriate and prudent to reclassify that building to a non-investment asset.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't want to distract from the whole presentation, but it'd be good to know how that was reflected on the books when that happened, if we could get that back.
Thank you, Senator Keel.
Dr.
Wilson.
Chair, we can send
you Senator
that information.
Senator
This is a follow-up. I think this is the sticky wicket last several years with the mental health, and it's nice that we're moving beyond it with the audit and the acquisition of the Texas real estate. And could we, Mr. Chairman, have the mental health group extend the tables that were in the audit showing the six properties year by year and their cash flow, and two of them now are going to be sold. The next several, I think, are going to be liquidated in the next couple of years or fairly short time, and that would be helpful for us. And also, I think on the, or let me rephrase it, the physical location of the building that Senator Keel was speaking about, that is in Anchorage, or where is that?
Through the chair. That's correct, Senator Seddon.
So it is not any of the Texas real estate, just for clarity. But I think updating that table is pretty clear. And you can look at the audit report, and you'll see them in there. It makes it easier for us to keep track of what's
Thank you, Senator Stedman. If your office, Dr. Wilson, can provide that to mine, and I could have that disseminated to the members of the committee.
To the chair, yeah, thank you, we will.
Dr. Wilson, please proceed with your presentation.
So this slide illustrates how we determine our available funding. On the left is the calculation we use to determine our annual budget for the future fiscal year. For FY26, that amount was $39.9 million. You see that at the bottom. The chart on the right illustrates that thanks to the use of averaging, we continue to see stable growth in our available funding. Before I dive in, I want to note that in late FY24, the Board of Trustees approved an update to the formula used to determine the annual expenditure amount. For this and future revenue calculations, a four-year average will be used for invested assets, but now the calculation will use a two-year average of both TLO income and the prior year's unexpended funds and the actual interest income from the most recent fiscal year. While these changes will increase certainty for the annual revenue calculation while not having a negative impact on it. So here's the funding starting at the top. The largest portion of our annual spend is funded through a withdrawal from our invested assets. This is 4.25% of the average value from the previous 4 years. We have a two-year average of prior funds carried forward. These are grants from previous years that have not been fully expended. In grant making, it is not uncommon that not all budgeted funds are utilized due to a variety of circumstances. Unused grant funds do roll back into our annual spend calculation, and with our new two-year average for this portion of our annual spend, they do so even more quickly. The Trust Land Office, or TLO, spendable income also contributes to our available spend estimate, shown here at $4.2 million, which is the two-year average. And lastly, we have close to $1.8 million in interest earnings from our most recent fiscal year that contribute to the spend. Per the 4.25%, this committee in the past has expressed an interest in our payout. The payout rate began at 3% at its inception and has slowly increased over time. Currently, the trustees are in dialogue with Callan, who has a contract to examine trust spending and help us consider whether changes to our payout percentage is in the best interest of trust beneficiaries, both those we support today and those we support in the future. Currently, Callan is working on that recommendation, and we should have that fairly soon.
Senator Stedman.
Just walks us right into the other discussion we're having around the table with the permanent fund. It would be nice if the mental health could notify you, Mr. Chairman, when they make that conclusion of the payout rate. I think that would be of interest to the committee. And I'll be surprised if it comes out at 5%. It'll probably be, my guess, is close to where it is right now at 4.25%.
Dr. Wilson, can you provide that to the chair and we'll get that disseminated as well?
Through the chair, yes, we will. Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
What we have shown here is how we determine the amount of our annual budget and how we look at how we're investing the trust funds in FY26. Please remember the entirety of the trust budget is self-funded. We don't use any state general fund dollars. Further, only the Board of Trustees has the authority to spend trust funds. So every increment we'll mention today was a part of our trustee-approved FY26 budget. And our budget development process is done closely in partnership with state agencies, providers, tribal organizations, nonprofits, beneficiaries, and other partners. So our fiscal year 26 budget totals about $40 million. The largest slice of the pie, the dark green, are the authority grants. These are trust grants awarded outside of the state budgeting process, directly from the trust to beneficiary-serving partners in the community. The Mental Health Trust Authority authorized receipts, or the MTAR grants, which is the yellow slice, are trust grants to state agencies. All of our MTAR increments, which I'll talk about more on the next slide, are developed in partnership with their recipient. All MTAR increments are a part of the state budget process. And as the name denotes, the legislature must provide receipt authority for these trust funds for their designated purpose in the state budget. These grants demonstrate a longstanding commitment to our state partners who have a critical role in serving beneficiaries. Since inception, we've granted about $270 million to state agencies. The role of trust funds is to support but not replace state funding. As you know, our total annual budget represents only a fraction of what the state spends to support health and wellness of Alaskans. Agency budgets for both the Trust Authority and the Trust Land Office are the last slices of the pie, which represent our operational expenses to lead in advocacy, system change efforts, administer grant funding, and actively manage and develop the trust lands. We have a team of 17 FTEs at the Trust Authority and 19 FTEs at the Trust Land Office. So this is a closer look at that yellow slice of the pie, which are the MTAR grants. Of the $10.2 million in MTAR funding, these are our many State of Alaska partners that receive trust funds through the State of Alaska budget process. Those of you who will serve on department budget subcommittees will see these MTAR increments as part of that process. There are more than 50 MTAR increments that have been transmitted to be included in the FY26 budget. This will be used for a variety of purposes, including capital funds for grant programs that work with trust beneficiaries, training programs for beneficiary-connected workforce, data and planning efforts, including the Comprehensive Integrated Mental Health Plan, and funding positions in multiple departments to focus on beneficiary issues. In addition to allocating trust funds to support beneficiaries, we're statutorily required to provide recommendations to the state for the use of general fund dollars to support trust beneficiaries. When we make these required recommendations, we consider the fiscal environment, and we work closely with our executive branch department partners in developing these recommendations, partnerships we greatly appreciate. This table represents the trustees' FY26 operating and capital general fund expenditure recommendations. This year, the governor's proposed budget includes some, about 35% of our recommendations. Most of the operating budget general fund mental health recommendations were included, although we see larger discrepancies in the capital budget items. We've worked productively and proactively with all the administrations since our inception in 1994, and that remains the case with Governor Dunleavy. And we appreciate the increments that are included in the proposed FY26 budget. We're happy to answer committee's questions on these, but before that, I want to highlight a couple of programs, and then we will. The Crisis Call Center, and we have a slide on this later. This is a $750,000 increment with an MTAR match that was developed in partnership with the Department of Health and is to support ongoing implementation of behavioral health crisis response services. The funds will support agencies implementing crisis call centers to provide direct intervention, a warm talk line, and services and/or referrals to treatment and recovery supports for trust beneficiaries experiencing severe mental illness, substance use disorders, or at-risk youth. We appreciate that this is included in the governor's budget. We also recommend a general fund funding for AHFC's special needs housing grants and the homeless assistance program. These grants provide primarily operating and supportive services for permanent supportive housing programs, and BHAP grants are awarded competitively and provide emergency or transitional housing and services to prevent homelessness or rapidly rehouse displaced people. Both programs are longstanding priority of the trust. This year, the governor did not include our GEF recommendations, but OMB did note that the HFC contributions to the program have been increased, resulting in an overall increase over last year's funding for these programs. We also want to recognize we're still early in the budget process, but we plan to continue with our dialogue with lawmakers about these recommendations and how they impact trust beneficiaries.
With that, the largest difference in the proposed budget by the Mental Health Trust and the governor's budget is in the capital budget, and Senator Stedman is the chairman, and I'm sure he will be diving into that and making recommendations to this committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This slide is showing you our trust focus and priority areas. These areas guide our grant funding and other work on behalf of beneficiaries, and each intersects with our beneficiary populations. We engage in work in disability justice, mental health and addiction intervention, which includes the Behavioral Health Crisis Response Team, beneficiary employment and engagement, housing and home and community-based services, workforce development, and early childhood intervention and prevention. Having these focus areas and priorities means we take a strategic approach toward building our system to meet beneficiary needs through grant making and our work in advocacy and systems change. These priorities have been developed and they evolve over time, considering our stakeholder engagement and the direction of our trustees. As part of our budgeting process, trustees approve spending in each of these areas each fiscal year. You can see the total amount of our FY26 budget associated with each of these areas. Additionally, each of the trust focus areas align with the state's Comprehensive Integrated Mental Health Program Plan, or the COMP plan. I'd like to take a moment to acknowledge and thank the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services for their partnership in finalizing the most recent COMP plan last fall. The trust supports this work and works closely with the state in developing it and implementing it. We'd be happy to meet with any of you who would like to learn more about our work across these focus areas.
A focus area that comes to mind, I guess, is of great concern to many Alaskans, and that is the people that are homeless. I know we've discussed that in the past, and there has been some attention given to that, but I'm wondering, from your viewpoint, is that being adequately addressed by the Mental Health Trust?
That issue. To the chair, I would say, first of all, we do concentrate on this area for our beneficiaries. It's a huge problem, as you know, and having access to a safe living space is absolutely necessary to regain any independence or social functioning after that. So we recognize that, and it is an area of priority for us and a focus area. And we partner with communities and the state around leveraging that. I think your question, though, is, are we doing enough, and is the trust remaining focused on this and doing more? I think there is more to do, and it definitely remains a focus area and will remain important to us as we go forward.
Well, that is of concern to me, and not only added attention to homelessness throughout the state of Alaska, but to ensure that we're looking at the total state and not just the largest communities of the state. If your office could get back to me and to see what we're doing on a statewide basis, I would greatly appreciate that, unless you wanted to make some comments today.
I think I have a few slides later where I can talk a little bit about where we are with the different programs, so that may help you, but we should also probably inform you of what's going on.
Okay.
You know, it's safe to say that if you've been homeless chronically, you're one of our beneficiaries.
Thank you. Senator Kaufman.
Thank you. Through the chair, to Ms. Wilson. Wondering, among your focus areas, I'm sure that internally you have some type of efficiency benchmark that you're working to as far as trust efficiency. The ratio of overhead relative to assets under management administration.
Yeah.
Could you tell me a little bit about that?
through the chair to the senator, just to be clear on what you're asking, are you talking about our overhead of the trust and the trust land office relative to the grant making, or are you talking about the grants being effective in their outcomes?
The overhead relative to the former.
Yes. So the trust land office, as you saw in one of those graphs, we've been stable. I have started to analyze that, so I can answer that a little bit. And if it's not enough, we can get you more written information. But we've gone up about 3% a year in terms of our bucket part of the spend, and compared to other grant making like funds or trusts, we do have low overhead, we think, but we're going to analyze. I want to analyze that. We do need to analyze that on a continuing basis. We want to be staffed just right to do the work, and we don't want to take our beneficiaries' money and spend it unwisely on staff.
Senator Coffman.
Thank you for that. I'd be interested to see any information that you can offer on what that process looks like or how it might be administered.
Yeah, through the chair, I can do that in writing to Senator Coffman, if that's okay.
Thank you, Senator Coffman. Dr. Wilson, please proceed.
So this talks about our FY24 grant awards across our focus and priority areas. We had 192 grants awarded to partners in communities across Alaska, totaling close to $24 million. While you see 17 dots on that map, what's not represented are the many grants that we award that have a statewide impact, such as support for university workforce training, reentry and mental health programs for inmates and reentrants, and expanding statewide access to developmental screening for infants and children. These grants represent those made both within and outside of the state budget process. So this includes MTAR and authority grants. As you can see from the type of grants awarded, we support everything from planning and the data needs that inform it, to actual services and facilities, to supporting quality trained staff that works directly with our beneficiaries. We prioritize our spending where it can serve as a catalyst for system improvement, and our grant funds are often leveraged with other community funders. A great example is our Crisis Now initiative, which you'll hear more about in an upcoming slide. Note the FY24 grant investment report, and I have it here, and I think you all should have it. This is what it looks like. If you want more information on every one of the grants that we give out. We have, as I said, 192 grants, and we have information about each one in the booklet. The report's a great resource to demonstrate the breadth and depth of our grant making in Alaska.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Wilson, the great benefit of the grant making approach is that you often can get the services delivered at a relatively low price point. And the downside is sometimes there are issues of stability among grantees or in the granting process. Can you talk to us a little bit about, in the last year or so, have we seen major shifts in community grantees' abilities to serve trust beneficiaries? Any significant changes there?
Yeah, thank you. Through the chair to Senator Keel. I'm going to get Katie, who's our COO, who has a really intimate knowledge of all the grant making. I think she'll be able to help with that answer.
Thank you, through the chair. Katie Baldwin-Johnson, Chief Operating Officer at the Trust. Yes, absolutely. One of the things the Trust has the ability to do is to really focus on capacity and supporting capacity of organizations in various ways. We're not just a grant-making organization. So we partner with organizations and communities that may be experiencing challenges because of reductions in funding or flat funding or workforce challenges that impacts their ability to operate services to meet their business plan in terms of their financial projections. So absolutely, yes, there are organizations and nonprofits across the state that are struggling. And certainly one of the areas that we prioritize is trying to support the capacity of those organizations to sustain and find other sustainable resources and financial contributions to those organizations, as well as to help get them connected with the technical assistance to work with their organizations on financial sustainability and other ways.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. Do you have... examples or things you could shine a light on how you prevent beneficiaries from losing services when grantees go through trouble?
Ms. Baldwin.
Through the chair. We do not do that in isolation. We work very closely with the Department of Health and the Department of Family and Community Services. If there is a way that the trust can lend our support, either in partnering with the state on trying to find some of those solutions, we certainly do that. We're typically not a funder of direct services. I think the way we best use our funds is to try to help those organizations problem solve. There have been some situations where organizations have closed, and we have been at the table in those conversations with our partners at the state to try to find some solutions for those beneficiaries.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I note the $9.5 million line for direct service, and I guess I'm hearing things about the past year, and I'm deeply concerned about potential for major changes in the coming year or two. So I'm interested in the Trust's approach to this.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Dr. Wilson, please proceed with your presentation.
Thank you. As we have for the past few years, I'd like to highlight some of our key initiatives, improving behavioral health crisis response. Like so many of our partners in law enforcement, treatment, dispatch, policymaking, and other areas impacted by psychiatric crises, we want to ensure that individuals in crisis have their needs met in the least restrictive manner and that they have someone to call, someone to respond, and a place to go. And that, in a nutshell, is the Crisis Now model, the components of which you see here on the slide. At its heart, this crisis initiative is about reducing the number of suicides, reducing inappropriate use of emergency rooms and correctional facilities, and providing the best support for individuals in crisis. We remain committed with funding and advocacy resources to our work to transform behavioral health crisis response in Alaska. Since we began this initiative 5 years ago, our Board of Trustees have committed about $20 million in grant funding toward it. In addition to funding, the Trust is serving as a leader in this space, using our staff expertise to support communities considering how to improve their crisis services, helping convene and connect partners, and serving as a steady champion for the work. The Trust has been actively partnering with the state since the initiative was launched, and that partnership has really allowed us to make strides in advancing new services. And we're seeing real-time data indicating the success of the implemented programs. A great example is the Fairbanks Mobile Crisis Team. This program has been operating for 3+ years and is reporting that 85% of its calls are now being resolved with team members in the community, with only 19% requiring law enforcement intervention or resolution at a hospital. Prior to this intervention, virtually all of them had to have a law enforcement encounter. Further, the mobile crisis teams conduct safety plans, interventions, and referrals, and offer transportation and warm handoffs and introductions to healthcare providers. We are seeing similar mobile teams operating in Anchorage, Mat-Su, Juneau, and Ketchikan. As you can see on the slide, crisis response work is underway in many communities across the state. It's inspiring to see leaders in these communities step forward and lean into this work, knowing that it is a better way to help individuals that experience mental health emergencies, and we're honored to support them. And just as an aside, when you think about crisis care, which is at the moment of suicide ideation or other crises, the best treatment for that is get in there right then. But if you don't manage ahead of upstream and downstream, it's going to happen over and over. So that's what this is about. So we see returns for an individual in that moment, but we see returns to the population of Alaska in general on that.
Please proceed.
Thank you. Now I'm going to transition to the Trust Land Office slides, and Jessie's going to come up and talk about that. She's the executive director of the TLO.
Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your comments.
Good morning, Mr. Chair. My name is Jessie Warner. I'm the executive director of the Alaska Mental Health Trust Land Office. Excuse me. So the Trust owns approximately 1 million acres of land statewide. We have an excellent team of professionals at the Trust Land Office, which sits within the Department of Natural Resources and is contracted exclusively with the Trust. The Trust Land Office has a responsibility by law to manage lands for one purpose, a sole purpose, and that is to maximize the revenue from those trust lands and resources. We have several asset classes noted on the screen that we manage within our portfolio: forestry, minerals and materials, energy, commercial real estate, program-related real estate, mitigation marketing, and lands. Revenue from the trust lands supports the trust's ongoing work on behalf of trust beneficiaries. Trust lands, like trust finances, are managed with perpetuity in mind. As you can see on the slide, we anticipate earning close to $33.3 million in revenues from our trust land assets this fiscal year. All decisions pertaining to trust land use are made considering how revenue from a parcel can be maximized, which may or may not line up with the public interest as a whole, though we work to align those two things as much as possible. Revenue is allocated between principal and income. For FY25, it is estimated that nearly $7.4 million will be principal, and the income will be just over $25 million.
Do you have policies on access to the million acres of trust land for Alaskans?
Mr.
Such
Chairman,
as hunting and fishing and camping.
Mr. Chairman, we do have a general land use policy. It's a general permit, and you can do any day use without any commercial entity. You can do that for free on trust land. If you overnight or take firewood or use it for commercial purposes, there's a fee.
What about hunting and fishing?
There's no fee for that if it's not commercial.
But there's access by Alaskans.
Yes, you can get, if it's day use, you can get to and from. If you're going to overnight, there's a small fee under a general permit that you can get over the counter.
For all Alaskans?
For all Alaskans.
And residents that are non-residents?
They also require the same general permit.
Same fee?
Same fee.
I wonder if you could provide the committee with a map of the million acres of land that you have. So I think it would be of interest to members of this committee to see where those land selections have been made.
Mr. Chairman, sure thing.
Senator Stedman.
Yeah, I'm just kind of curious on, I know the trust is in the business, and they're not a charity, put it that way, and trying to take care of the beneficiaries, but is the revenue generated from Alaskans' subsistence, hunting and fishing and recreation camping, worth the bureaucratic overhead to do the permits?
Mr. Chairman, through the chair.
Ms. Warner.
Senator Stedman, that's a great question. We have streamlined that process because it's not a high revenue number. That's why it's online, it's over the counter, it's electronic, it's automated. You go on, put your information in, and it gives you a permit. So the overhead is very small compared to what the return is, but the return is not high.
And the enforcement is non-existent.
Mr. Chairman, that is true. Mr. Chairman, it's the honor system.
Good to hear. Senator Stedman? Thank you.
Okay. So I'll just highlight a few things for the Trust Land Office for fiscal year 24. Last year was another great year for the Land Office as we generated more than $17 million for the Trust, and that was transferred directly to the Alaska Mental Health Trust Authority. The Trust Land Office timber sales generated over $1.9 million in revenue and supported roughly 150 jobs. The Trust Land Office has four active timber sales ranging from 4 to 8 years remaining under the contract and an estimated total of 47.5 million board feet of timber to be harvested. The vast majority of this revenue is generated from two timber sales in southeast Alaska, one near Shelter Cove outside of Ketchikan, and one near Nocatee on Prince of Wales. We also have a unique sale, a forest fuels mitigation project, through a contract with the Gateway School District. with the removal of hazardous forest fuels on 120 acres of trust land surrounding the Toke School. The wood is harvested, chipped, and processed into biomass fuel, which is subsequently used to heat the Toke School. Last year was also a great year for the trust land sales. We offer a land sale auction of select parcels each year, as well as an ongoing over-the-counter sale. We also consider negotiated sales. Last fiscal year, the Trust Land Office financed land sale contracts and outright land purchases are projected to earn the Trust more than $10.5 million over the lifetime of those contracts. Also in FY24, six subdivision projects were completed across three different communities, Homer, Fairbanks, and Central Kenai. The Trust Land Office currently has 10 subdivision development projects in various phases of active development in five different communities across the state. Along with the work on those projects in active development, initial feasibility work began on 11 additional projects in fiscal year 24.
Well, there's, Ms. Warner, there's been a great interest in addressing homes and new home construction in Alaska and getting land to Alaskans so that they can build their homes. My question is, how are those subdivision locations selected by and recommended by you to the board?
Mr. Chairman, that's a great question. The trust owns land near communities. That's just by virtue of how the land selections work. They were surveyed at the time, and so that's what was transferred through the selections to the trust. We also look at the feasibility of a project, the housing needs, the price point, and one thing that we really look towards, which can hamstring a project, is the cost of roads and utilities, putting that infrastructure in, and what that will do to the price point of that lot for that return for the trust.
Senator Stedman.
Can you help me a little bit with what do you do and what options do you have when you have a parcel that doesn't meet the hurdle rate of return, but it might be fairly close but not quite there due to the capital cost of roads and power lines and water? Is there a program you're looking at?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. That for the trust will kill a project. If the economics do not make a return, and with also coming with a substantial amount of risk based on that return, that will kill the project and we won't move forward. There is a program that we're looking at through the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation that they have a pot of funds that we're looking to potentially secure, which would turn some of those projects that are economically not feasible into having some feasibility to further that mission of getting those lands subdivided and Alaskans some housing in those communities.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And just for the newer members of the committee, last year the Finance Committee was struggling with this issue, how to get the Alaska Mental Health Group, the university, and DNR that have vast real estate holdings around the state with potential for subdivisions for housing that are uneconomic but close. How do we de-risk them and move them forward? So we have had $4 million in last year's budget held by the Alaska Housing, and they will play the referee between those three Alaska-owned entities and decide how to what subdivisions that when they bring them forward could use an equity infusion to lower the capital cost and allow that particular subdivision then to hit its hurdle rate and move forward and get the land on the market, the roads and power in, so they could the land could get on the tax rolls and houses could be built. It's in the infancy. It's the first year. We'll be talking a little bit about it later on, I'm sure, as we get looking at the budget in detail, but it appears to be a pretty successful program so far, and Alaska Mental Health is interested in accessing that, and there's dialogue going along with that, along with DNR. So anyway, I just thought I'd cue you up to advertise the work of the Senate Finance Committee. I just had to give you a little more bait.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. We may get have a hearing at this table by the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to see what they've done with the direction that we've given them. But of these six subdivisions that are completed and others that are in phases of development, I'm sure the people how are the individuals selected? Because I'm sure there's a big interest in that. And to me, it would seem that there needs to be some additional direction, because the people that have the funds to purchase these parcels, I'm sure there are many, but there are others that are maybe marginal that are in mid-income or low-income that are trying to get a home as well. And is that addressed by your office?
Mr. Chairman, we do look for creative solutions to meet the needs of those communities. So we've engaged with a number of communities, local boroughs around the state, to see what their needs are and really understand, you know, how can we meet both what the needs are in the community and still meet that maximization of revenue. And occasionally that will be making for smaller lots, selling throughout a different set of a time frame. So we're really working towards like meeting that and both needs. We just recently signed a memorandum of understanding with the city and borough of Wrangell, which has the local government and the trust coming together to say, we're going to work in partnership to get this done. And although it's not binding, it is that promise from both sides to say, we're working together for a common goal, and we'll find these creative solutions to make this happen. So we're really looking forward to that and hoping to secure that in other boroughs.
Please proceed, Ms. Warner.
Thank you. So the Trust Land Office generates revenue through resource development on trust lands that includes renewable resources. In fiscal year 24, we finalized our first renewable energy project ground lease, diversifying our portfolio on trust lands. This lease supports a solar energy project on 680 acres of trust land near Nikiski that proposes to generate 28.5 megawatts of cost-competitive energy to interconnect with the Homer Electric Association utility. The solar energy project represents an opportunity to generate approximately over $3 million in royalty payments for the trust and its beneficiaries in the first lease. This project further incentivizes solar power generation on adjacent trust lands with the option for a second lease, providing the opportunity to develop a second phase of the project for an increased return to the trust. The Icy Cape Exploration Project is a large volume placer gold and industrial minerals district, including critical minerals, on trust lands about 75 miles northwest of Yakutat. All exploration work is carried out by the TLO, or the Trust Land Office. The Icy Cape land block is approximately 50,000 acres in size. 23,000 acres are underlain by nearshore marine sediments that contain gold and industrial minerals, including garnet and epidote group minerals. The sediments also contain critical minerals such as zirconium, titanium, yttrium, and platinum group metals. However, this is predominantly a placer gold project with industrial minerals as co-products. The TLO's exploration has focused on the Grinder prospect, just one of many gold discoveries in the district, such as Dr. Rock, Hammersmith, and Tailgunner. Gold and industrial minerals assay data from Grinder are encouraging, and the metallurgical test studies, including bulk sediment sample testing, have also produced encouraging results. A mineral resource estimate, including a technical report on the Grinder prospect, is expected to be completed this year. This work is carried out by industry experts that have extensive experience on these types of deposits.
Can you provide the committee with more detailed information on this exploration project? It seems quite interesting. Senator Teal.
Thank, Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Werner, when you say all exploration work is performed by the trust, so the trust is acting as the junior mining company, or the trust has a lease out to someone? Tell me how that works.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the trust is actually acting as the junior in this case.
Senator Keel.
Thank you. When other state agencies have resources that are prospective, that look good, classically we allow a private company to take shoulder the risk of exploration. I've never met a gold prospect that didn't look amazing. And yet, a lot of junior mining companies end up walking away from a lot of prospects. Can you talk us through the trust's decision to take on what sounds like 100% of the risk?
Ms. Warner.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, great question. The Trust Land Office has a resource geologist on staff, 25 years of experience in these kind of deposit types, has worked all over the world in this type of role. We did get an approval from the Board of Trustees to expend a certain number of dollars to put towards this project. We report to the trustees on a quarterly basis of the steps, the updates, all along the way. So at any point, the board can say, oh, wait, we might not want to do this. So that's kind of how the land office is handling it. That's how the board is handling it as a whole. I'm going to stop there, see if you have a follow-up.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you talk to us about how you assess the risk of this particular set of investment decisions in the overall risk portfolio of the Mental Health Trust Authority?
Ms. Warner.
Mr. Chairman, or through the chair, Senator Keel. Yes, so this project started in 2015, just basic research of what was out there on the books in reports that have been done by maybe the Bureau of Mines and others that have sort of explored this area. Then there was some exploration works, which means they drilled some holes out there to see and got the results back. Well, that looked pretty good. Then a little more was done. And so each step along the way, it's been a long process, but we have done the exploration in a way that the junior would do it. It's just taken a little bit more time because we were extra cautious on what we were finding in those results from those drill holes.
One last one, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Keel.
Thank you. Can you share with us the trust's plan for assessing when and how to move forward and when or whether to lease to a producing partner if everything continues to look as good as it does, or does the Trust Land Office plan to become a mining company?
Ms. Warner.
Through the chair, Senator Keel, the Trust Land Office does not plan on becoming a mining company. So how it kind of works is this year we'll produce that technical report. It's done by a third-party qualified persons. They'll review all of the data. And then that will come back, and at that point we'll look for an industry partner, maybe to lease it out, and they will develop it. They will do the production. We are very close to that point to where we would turn it over. Our next step is securing this report and then aggressive advertisement and marketing of the project worldwide.
Senator Keel?
I'll follow up offline. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Keel. Ms. Warner?
So the Trust Land Office has a cost recovery plan in place, which was approved by the Board of Trustees, whereby once the project goes into production, the first revenues will go to pay back the income expended by the trust. There is opportunity at Icy Cape It is a large, underexplored gold and industrial minerals district with enormous potential for additional mineral deposit discoveries. Four large prospects have been identified so far, but airborne magnetic and gradient magnetic surveys provide compelling evidence for additional large-scale placer deposit discoveries. Opportunity continues as we estimate $100 to $150 million in revenue generation from Grindr alone, and we expect mineral exploration at Icy Cape to significantly increase once the Trust Land Office has an industry partner for the development of Grindr. The size of the district allows several developers to operate simultaneously. With more exploration work by the Trust Land Office on the other discoveries, we expect more industry to invest in the district and in mineral development. These are large-scale placer deposits, not hard rock deposits, which means that the mining and operating costs will be significantly lower, making these deposits more attractive to industry. Gold is always in demand, and there is a shortage of premium garnet sand in the United States. The United States markets support gold and industrial minerals from Icy Cape. The demand for critical minerals underlines this support. As a reminder, the sediments at Icy Cape also contain those critical minerals that we are seeing the need nationwide.
Senator Stedman.
So why did the land office select this parcel? Did they select the parcel for housing construction or mineral development?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I would have to go back and look and see what they originally selected this parcel for. I will tell you the use of this parcel has been very diversified for the land office, and it is a high producing parcel. We've harvested a lot of timber off of this parcel. We also have a big game guide operator out there that works exclusively to guide clients.
Senator Stedman.
It might come as a shock, but there's no residential development up there. It's mineral development. That's why it was selected. We have an opportunity here that is very, very attractive. And I'm looking forward to the day it gets developed. It'll create a lot of jobs in the area. I'm hoping we even get some remuneration from this end, from the trust, from it. We'll wait and see. But I think it's a very bright prospect, and I would put it right up there with some of the activity on the North Slope, as far as a game changer to a region of the state.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. Ms. Warner, I have several gold mines in my district. Two of the larger ones are Pebble Mine and Donland Creek. And mining is controversial in the state. The concern Alaskans have, at least the people in my district, are contamination of the waters, what is going to happen with the cleanup, and most importantly, who is going to take care of restoration. Can you address those issues for Icy Cape?
Mr. Chairman, sure thing. So this is just a placer gold operation on the beach sands, and so oversimplifying it completely, it's really washing sand with water. It's one of the more environmentally friendly mines. It's not something that is going to produce tailings or any acid rock generation. It's very different than that hard rock sort of mine. The challenge, though, with Icy Cape is that it is so remote that when you build your barge landing, you have to rebuild it at every tide because it just erodes it away. But there is no environmental concerns from our side that would ultimately hamstring this project.
So there are no permits that are required for from the federal government for this operation?
Mr. Chairman,
yes.
There seems to always be federal permits required. however, this is one of the cleaner ways of mining, so we see that risk as lower than it would be for, let's say, a volcanic massive sulfide mine or something like that nature.
Does that conclude your presentation?
It does. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Werner. Are there comments or questions on IC Cape? Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we close, and I'm not trying to beat the dead horse because the horse is dead. That goes back to the real estate holdings. And there's a document that was in our packet, showed some cash flows and a few things. So maybe the trust office could, when they look at these six projects and give us a multi-year kind of review, put in the potential market value so we can see the debt to equity issues, also an explanation on the lease-up costs because they're fairly substantial and have impacted the cash flow substantially. Kind of address some of that stuff so it's easier for us to track along over the next few years while we work slowly through the liquidation of these over the next several years.
Through the chair, thank you. Yeah, we'll do that for you. In addition to what you got, we'll add that stuff.
Okay.
Thank you. So I just wanted to thank everybody. And final remarks, as you heard, the trust is a perpetual trust, and that means that we're accountable today's beneficiaries, but also all beneficiaries in the future. Our annual spend to support our beneficiaries is we manage via effective, we think, and expert leadership, and always in partnership with stakeholders across the state. I hope you see we're prudent and effective overseers of the trust funds. And we use our expertise in partnerships to really strategically drive changes overall over the years in the population of Alaska. So thank you very much for your time.
I have a question on the board composition. Do you have any members that are from rural Alaska that are on the board?
Thank you. To the chair, we have one member from Ketchikan, and the other six members are from
I didn't know Ketchikan was from rural Alaska, Senator Stedman.
Sorry about that.
It's pretty rural, Mr. Chairman.
When I was there, it didn't feel very rural to me. My several visits to Ketchikan. But when I was in Tuntutuliak, I felt like I was in rural Alaska.
And Senator Hoffman, the trustees are appointed by the governor and nominated through a varied process. So,
But you submit those names, do you not?
The Board of Trustees submit those names, correct.
So that's how the question works. Is, if you don't submit people from rural Alaska, they will never get nominated.
That is true. That is true. Thank you.
The other question that I have is on legislation, proposed legislation by the Mental Health Trust. Are there any, and in particularly Title 47, are there updates there? I think there's a big concern about how that is being administered. Do you have any comments on?
I don't, but I'm going to get Katie up to talk about that. Thanks. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, through the Chair, Katie Baldwin Johnson. At this time, the Trust is not supporting or, moving any active legislation regarding that. It's potential that we'll be working with the state and our partners on some policy issues, whether or not that will result in any type of written legislation proposed related to our crisis work. That's still yet to be determined. But at this point in time, we don't have anything active that we're actively...
It would seem to me that not everything is hunky-dory in the legislative books of the state of Alaska. Otherwise, we wouldn't have the problems that we have. And I would assume that there are all the issues that you're dealing with. There must be some ways to improve them legislatively. So look forward to hearing from the trust on that very, very important issue.
Thank you.
Do you have any closing comments?
Thank you.
Doctor? Does any committee members have any final comments? If not, let me check my schedule here. That concludes the meeting for today. Our next meeting is tomorrow, February the 7th at 9 a.m. here in the Senate Finance Committee room. We will be hearing from the Department of Revenue. They will be giving us an update of our savings, reserves, and investment funds. With that, we stand adjourned.
Yes.